2 of chapter 4. It was then that Heracles was given arms by the gods, the sword of Hermes, the bow of Apollo, the shield made by Hephaestus. It was then that Heracles joined the Argonauts and journeyed with them to the edge of Caucasus, where, slaying the vulture that preyed upon Prometheus' liver, he, at the will of Zeus, liberated the Titan. Thereafter, Zeus and Prometheus were reconciled, and Zeus, that was neither might forget how much the enmity between them had cost gods and men, had a ring made for Prometheus to wear. A ring that was made out of a fetter that had been upon him, and in it was set a fragment of the rock that the Titan had been bound to. The Argonauts had now won back to Greece, but before he saw any of them, he had been in Oesalia and had seen the maiden Iole. The king of Oechalia had offered his daughter Iole in marriage to the hero who could excel himself to his sons in shooting with arrows. Heracles saw Iole, blue-eyed and childlike maiden, and he longed to take her with him to some place near the garden of the Hesperides. And Iole looked at him, and he knew that she wondered to see him so tall and strongly knit, even as he wondered to see her so childlike and delicate. When the contest began. The king and his sons shot wonderfully well. None of the heroes could stood before Heracles and a chance of winning. Then Heracles shot his arrows. No matter how far away they moved the mark, Heracles struck it and in the very center of it. The people wondered who this great archer might be, and then the name was guessed at it went round. Heracles! Then the king heard the name of Heracles. He would not let them strive in the contest anymore, for the maiden Iole would not be given as a prize to one who had been mad and whose madness might afflict them again. So the king said, speaking in judgment in the marketplace. Rage came upon Heracles, and he heard this judgment given. He could not let his rage master him, lest the madness was spoken of should come with his rage. So he left the city of Oechalia, declaring to the king and the people that he would return. And it was that wandering down to Crete, he heard of the Argonauts being near, and afterward he heard of them being in Calydon hunting the boar that ravaged Aeneas' country. To Calydon Heracles went. The heroes had departed when he came to the country, and all the city was in grief for the deaths of Prince Meleagrus and his two uncles. On the steps of the temple where Meleagrus and his uncles had been brought, Heracles saw Deneira, Meleagrus' sister. She was pale with her grief, this tall woman of the mountains. She looked like a priestess, but also like a woman who could never cheer camps of men with her counsel, her bravery, and her good companionship. Her hair was very dark, and she had dark eyes. Straight away she became friends with Heracles, and when they saw each other for a while, they loved each other. And Heracles forgot Iole, the childlike maiden whom he had seen in Oechalia. He made himself suitor for Deneira, and those who protected her were glad of Heracles' suit, and they told him that they would give him the maiden to marry. As soon as the mourning of Prince Meleagrus and his uncles was over, Heracles stayed in Calydon, happy with Deneira, who had much beauty, wisdom, and bravery. But then a dreadful thing happened in Caledon. By an accident, while using his strength unthinkingly, Heracles killed a lad who was related to Deneira. He might not marry her now until he had taken punishment for slaying one who was close in her blood. As a punishment for slaying, it was judged that Heracles should be sold into slavery for 3 years. At the end of his 3 years' slavery, he would come back to Caledon. And so Heracles and Deneira would be parted. He was sold in a slave in Lydia, and one who brought him as a was a woman, a widow named Omphale. To her house Heracles went, carrying his armor and wearing the lion's skin. And Omphale laughed to see this tall man dressed in a lion's skin coming to her house to do a servant's tasks for her. She and all in her house kept up fun with Heracles. They would set him with housework, carry water, and set vessels on tables and clear the vessels away. Omphale set him to spin with a spindle as women did. And often she would put on Heracles' lion skin and go about dragging his club while he dressed in woman's garb, washed dishes and empty pots. But he would lose patience with these servants' tasks, and when Omphale would let him go away and performed some great exploit. Often he went on long journeys and stayed away for long times. It was while he was in slavery to Omphale that he was liberated, that he liberated Theseus from the dungeon in which he held with Pirithous, and it was while he still was in slavery that he made his journey to Troy. At Troy, he helped the repair of King Laomedon and great walls that years before Apollo and Poseidon had built around the city. As a reward for this labor, he was offered the princess Hazon in marriage. She was the daughter of King Laomedon, the sister of Priam, who was then called not Priam but Podarces. He helped to repair the wall, and the two of the Argonauts were there to aid him. One was Pelias and the other was Telamon. Pelias did not stay for long. Telamon stayed, and to reward Telamon, Heracles withdrew his own claim from the hand of Princess Hazon. It was not hard on Heracles to do this, for his thoughts were upon Deneira. But Telamon rejoiced, for he loved Hazon greatly. On the day they married, Heracles showed the two an eagle in the sky. He said it was sent as an omen to them, an omen for their marriage. And in a memory that omen, Telamon named his son Aias, that is, eagle. Then the walls of Troy were repaired. Heracles turned down toward Lydia, Omphale's home. Not long would he have to serve Omphale now, for his 3 years of slavery were nearly gone. Soon he would go back to Caledon and wed Deneira. As he went along the road to Lydia, he thought of all the pleasantries he made in Omphale's house, and he laughed at the memory of them. Lydia was a friendly country, and even though he had been in slavery, Heracles had his good times there. He was tired with the journey and made sleepy with the heat of the sun, and when he came within the sight of Omphale's house, he lay down by the side of the road, first taking off his armor, laying aside his bow and his quiver and his shield. He wakened up to see two men looking down upon him. He knew that these were the Cercops, robbers who waylaid travelers upon this road. They were laughing as they looked down on him, and Heracles saw that they held his arms and his armor in their hands. They thought that this man, for all this tallness, would yield to them, and when he saw that they had his arms and his armor. But Heracles sprang up, and he caught one by his waist and the other by the neck, and turned them upside down and tied them together by the heels. Now he held them securely and would take them to town to give them over to those they had waylaid and robbed. He hung them by the heels across his shoulders and marched on. But the robbers, as they were being bumped along, began to relate pleasantries and mirthful tales to each other, and Heracles, listening, had to laugh. And one said to the other, "Oh, my brother, we are in position of the frogs when the mice fell upon them with such a fury." And the other said, "Indeed, nothing can save us if Zeus does not send an ally to us as he sent an ally of frogs." And the first robber said, "Who began the conflict, the frogs or the mice?" And thereupon the second robber, his head reaching down to Heracles' waist, began. A warlike mouse came down to the brink of a pond from no reason to drink water. Up to him hopped the frog, speaking in the voice of who had rule and authority. The frog said, "Stranger to our shore, you may not know it, but I am Puffjaw, king of the frogs. I do not speak common to mice, but as to you, I judge, belong to a noble and kingly sort. Tell me your race. If I know it to be a noble one, I shall know you my kingly friendship." The mouse, speaking haughtily, said, "I am Crumb Snatcher. My race is a famous one. My father is Bread Nibbler, and he married Fern Licker, the lovely daughter of a king. Like all my race, I am a warrior who has never been wont to flinch in battle. Moreover, I have been brought up as a mouse of high degree, and figs and nuts, cheese, honey, and honey cakes is in provender that I have been fed in." Now, this reply of Crumb Snatcher pleased the kingly frog greatly. "Come with me and to my abode, illustrious Crumb Snatcher," he said, "and I shall show you such entertainments as may be found in the house of a king." But the mouse looked sharply at him. "How may I get to your house?" he said. "We live in different elements, and you and I, we mice want to be in the driest of dry places, while you frogs have your abodes in the water." "Ah," answered Puffjaw, "you do not know how favored frogs are above all other creatures. To us alone, the gods have given the power to live both in water and on land. I shall take you to my land palace that is in the other side of the pond." "How may I go there with you?" asked Crumb Snatcher, the mouse, doubtfully. "Upon my back," said the frog. Up now, noble Crumb Snatcher, as we go, I will show you the wonders of the deep." He offered his back to Crumb Snatcher bravely, and Crumb Snatcher bravely mounted. The mouse put his forepaws around the frog's neck. Then Puffjaw swam out. Crumb Snatcher at first was pleased to feel himself moving through the water, but as the dark waves began to rise, his mighty heart began to quail. He longed to be back upon the land. He groaned aloud. How quickly will we get on?" cried Puffjaw. "Soon we shall be in my land palace." Heartened by this speech, Crumb Snatcher put his tail into the water and worked it as a steering oar. On and on they went, and Crumb Snatcher gained heart for the adventure. What a wonderful tale he would have to tell to the clans of mice. But suddenly, out of the depths of the pond, the water snake raised his horrid head. Fearsome did that head seem to both mouse and frog, and forgetful of the guest that he was carried upon his back, Puffjaw dived down into the water. He reached the bottom of the pond and lay down on the mud in safety, but far from the safety was Crumb Snatcher the mouse. He sank and rose and sank again. His wet fur weighed him down, but before he sank for the last time, he lifted up his voice and cried out a cry that was heard at the brink of the pond. "Ah, Puffjaw, treacherous frog, an evil thing you have done, leaving me to drown in the middle of the pond. Have you faced me on the land, I should have shown you which of us two was better warrior. Now I must lose my wife in the water. But I tell you, my death shall not go unavenged. The cowardly frogs will be punished for the ill they had done to me, a son of a king of the mice." When Crumb Snatcher sank for the last time, but Lick Patter, who was at the brink of the pond, had heard these words. Straightway this mouse rushed to the hole of Bread Nibbler, and told him of the death of his princely son. The Bread Nibbler called out the clans of mice. The warrior mice armed themselves, and this was the grand way of their arming. First, the mice put on greaves that covered their forelegs. These were made out of bean shells broken in two. For a shield, each had a lamb's centerpiece. For spears, they had long bronze needles that they had carried out of Hal's men. So armed and so encountered, they were ready to war upon the frogs. And Bread Nibbler, their king, shouted to them, "Fall upon the cowardly frogs, and leave not one alive upon the bank or of the pond. Henceforth, the bank is ours and ours only. Forward!" And on the other side, Puffjaw was urging the frogs to battle. "Let us take our places to the edge of the pond," he said, "and then the mice come upon amongst us. Let us catch hold of one and throw him into the pond. Thus we will get rid of these dry bobs, the mice." The frogs applauded the speech of their king, and straightway they went to their armor and weapons. Their legs they covered with leaves of mallow. For breastplates they had leaves of beets. Cabbage leaves, well cut, made their strong shields. They took spears from the pond side. Deadly pointed rushes they were, snail shells. So armed and encountered, they were ready to meet the grand attack of mice. When the robber came to this part of the story, Heracles halted his march, for he was shaking with laughter. The robber stopped in his story. Heracles slapped him on the leg and said, "What more of the heroic exploits of mice?" The second roarer said, "I know no more, but perhaps my brother at the other side can tell you the mighty combat between them and the frogs." Then Heracles shifted from the first robber from his back to his front, and the first robber said, "I will tell you what I know about the heroical combat between the frogs and mice." And thereupon he began. The gnats blew their trumpets. This was a dread signal of war. Bread Nibbler struck the first blow. He fell upon the loud crier of a frog and overthrew him. At this loud crier's friend, Reedy, threw down spear and shield and dived into the water. This seemed to presage victory for mice. But then Waterlarker, the most warlike of the frogs, took up a great pebble and flung it at Ham Nibbler, who was pursuing Reedy. Down fell Ham Nibbler, and there was dismay in the ranks of mice. Then Cabbage Climber, a great-hearted frog, took up a clod of mud and flung it full at a mouse who was coming furiously upon him. The mouse helmet was knocked off, and his forehead was plastered with the clod of mud, so that he was well nigh blinded. It was then that the victory inclined to the frogs. Red Nibbler again came into a fray. He rushed furiously upon Puffjaw the king. Leakley, the trusted friend of Puffjaw, opposed Red Nibbler's onslaught. Mightily he drove his spear at Nibbler, at the king of mice. But the point of the spear broke upon the Red Nibbler's shield, and when Leakey was overthrown, Red Nibbler came upon Puffjaw, and the two great kings faced each other. The frogs and mice drew aside, and there was a pause in the combat. Red Nibbler the mouse struck Puffjaw the frog terribly upon the toes. Puffjaw drew out the battle. Now all would have been lost for the frogs had not Zeus, the father of the gods, looked down upon the battle. "Dear, dear," said Zeus, "what can be done to save the frogs? They surely had been annihilated in charge of the yonder mouse is not halted." For the father of the gods, looking down, saw a warrior mouse coming on the most dreadful oversight of the whole battle. Slice Snatcher was the name of this warrior. He had come late into the field. He waited for to split a chestnut in two and to put the halves upon his paws. And then, fiercely dashing among the frogs, he cried out that he would not leave the ground until he had destroyed the race, leaving the bank of the pond a playground of mice and of mice alone. To stop the charge of Sly Snatcher, there was nothing for Zeus to do but to hurl a thunderbolt that is the terror of the gods and men. Frogs and mice were awed by the thunder and flame. Still, as the mice, urged by Sly Snatcher, did not hold back from their onslaught upon the frogs. Now the frogs would have been utterly destroyed. But as they dashed on, the mice encountered a new and dreadful army. The warriors in the ranks had nailed backs of curving claws. They had bandy legs, long stretching arms, and they had eyes that looked behind them. They came on sideways. These were the crabs, creatures until now unknown to the mice. And the crabs had been sent by Zeus to save the race of the frogs from utter destruction. Coming upon the mice, they nipped their paws. The mice turned around and they nipped their tails. In vain, the boldest of the mice struck at the crabs with their sharpened spears. Not upon the hard shells on the backs of the crabs did the spears of the mice make any dent. On and on their queer feet, and with their terrible nippers, the crabs went. Red Nibbler could not rally them anymore, and Sly Snatcher ceased to speak of the mountment of victory that the mice would erect upon the bank of the pond. With their heads out of the water, they retracted to as the frogs watched the finish of the battle. The mice drew down their spears and shields and fled from the battleground. On went the crabs as they cared for nothing for their victory, and the frogs came out of the water and sat upon the bank and watched them in awe. Heracles had laughed at the diverting tale that the robber birds told him, and he could not bring them to a place where they should meet with captivity or death. He let them loose upon the highway, and the robbers thanked him with the high flowing speeches, and they declared that if they should ever find him sleeping in the roadway again, they would let him lie. Saying as they went away, and Heracles, laughing at the thought upon the great exploits of frogs and mice, went on to Omphale's house. Omphale, the widow, received him mirthfully, and then sat him to do tasks in the kitchen, while he sat and talked to him about Troy and affairs to King Glaucon. And after he put on his lion skin, he went about the courtyard, dragging the heavy club after her. Mirthfully and pleasantly, she made the rest of his time in Lydia. In Lydia passed for Heracles, and the last day of his slavery soon came, and he bade goodbye to Omphale, that pleasant widow, and to Lydia, and started off for Calydon to claim his bride Dinara. Beautiful indeed Dinara looked, now that she had ceased to mourn for her brother, for the laughter that had been under her grief always now flashed out, even while she looked priestess-like and good of counsel. Her dark eyes shone like stars, and her being had the spirit of one who wanders from camp to camp, always greeting friends and leaving friends behind her. Heracles and Dinara were wed, and they sent out for Tiryns, where a king had left a kingdom to Heracles. They came to the river Evenus. Heracles would have crossed the river by himself, but he could not cross it at the part he came to carrying Dinara. He and she went along the river, seeking a ferry that might take them across. They wandered along the side of the river, happy with each other, and they came to a place where they had the sight of a centaur. Heracles knew the centaur. He was Nessus, one of the centaurs whom he had chased up on the mountain the time when he went to hunt with the Arimathean boar. The centaur knew him, and Nessus spoke to Heracles as if he had friendship for him. He would, he said, carry Heracles' bride across the river. Then Heracles crossed the river and waited on the other side for Nessus and Dinara. Nessus went on the other part of the river to make his crossing. Then Heracles, upon the other bank, heard screams. The screams were of his wife, Dinara. He saw that the centaur was savagely attacking her. Then Heracles leveled his bow and shot at Nessus. Arrow after arrow, he shot at the centaur's body. Nessus loosened his hold on Dinara and lay down on the bank of the river, his lifeblood streaming from him. Then Nessus, dying, but with rage against Heracles, unabated, thought of a way by which the hero might be made to suffer for the death he had brought upon him. He called to Dinara, and she, seeing that he could do her no more hurt, came close to him. He told her that in repentance for his attack upon her, he would bestow a great gift upon her. She was to gather up some of the blood that flowed from him. His blood, the centaur said, would be a love filter, and if ever her husband's love for her waned, it would grow fresh again. And she gave to him something from her hands that would have his blood upon it. Dinara, who had heard from Heracles of the wisdom of centaurs, believed that Nessus told what had Nessus told her. She took a phial and let the blood pour into it. Then Nessus plunged into the river and died there as Heracles came up to where Dinara stood. She did not speak to him about the centaur's words to her, nor did she tell him that she had hidden away the phial that had Nessus's blood in it. They crossed the river at another point, and they came after a time to the Tyrians and the kingdom that had been left to Heracles. There Heracles and Dinara lived, and a son, who was named Hylos, was born to them. And after a time, Heracles was led into a war with Aertius. Aertius was the king of Ochalia. Word came to Deneira that Ochalia was taken by Heracles, and that the king and his daughter Io were held captive. Deneira knew that Heracles had once tried to win this maiden for his wife, and she feared that the sight of Io would bring his old longing back to him. She thought upon the words that Nessus had said to her, and even as she thought upon them, messengers came from Heracles to ask her to send a robe, a beautiful woven robe that she had, that he might wear it while making a sacrifice. Deneira took down the robe. Through his robe, she thought, the blood of the centaur would touch Heracles, and his love for her would revive. Thinking this, she poured Nessus' blood over the robe. Heracles was in Ochalia when the messengers returned to him. He took the robe that Deneira sent, and he went to a mountain that overlooked the sea, that he might make the sacrifice there. Io went with him. Then he put on the robe that Deneira had sent. When it touched his flesh, the robe burst into flame. Heracles tried to tear it off, but deeper and deeper his flesh, the flames went. They burned and burned, and none could quench him. Then Heracles knew that his end was near. He would die by fire, knowing that he piled up a great heap of wood. He climbed upon it, and there he stayed with the flaming robe burning into him, and he begged of those who passed to fire the pile, that his end might come more quickly. None would fire the pile, but last there came the young warrior named Philoctetes, and Heracles begged him to fire the pile. Philoctetes, knowing that it was the will of the gods that Heracles should die that the way, lighted the pile, for Heracles bestowed upon him his great and his unwearying arrows. And it was that his bow and these arrows brought from Philoctetes that afterward helped to make Priam's city. The pile that Heracles stood upon was fired. High up above the sky, the pile was burned. All who were near that burning fled, all except Io, that childlike maiden. She stayed and watched the flames mount up and up. They wrapped the sky, and the voice of Heracles was heard calling upon Zeus. Then a great chariot came, and Heracles was borne away to Olympus. Thus, after many labors, Heracles passed away, a mortal passing into an immortal, being in a great burning high above the sky, above the sea. Bye, guys. See you later. See you later. See you later. See ya. See ya. Later. Bye, guys.